I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Presidential primaries continue tomorrow in Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, and Florida. President Bush is campaigning and raising money where he feels most at home, Texas. But presumptive Democratic nominee Massachusetts Senator John Kerry is far from home in the critical state of Florida. Joining us on the line is Adam Smith, political editor for the St. Petersburg Times, who's following the Kerry campaign today. Welcome, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
Good, and thanks for joining us. How close is the race between Kerry and Bush in Florida right now?
Well, we actually had a poll this weekend taken right after he essentially locked up the nomination on Super Tuesday, and Kerry's actually leading slightly. It was 49 Kerry, 43 Bush. So it's going to be a very close race, it looks like, again.
Why do you think Kerry's leading slightly? What are the issues that are driving support for Kerry?
Well, first of all, the poll was taken right after he is at weeks of very good publicity, winning all these caucuses and primaries. So it may be a little bit high. The Bush campaign hasn't really gone at him full throttle yet. But our poll found a lot of voters, particularly independent voters who tend to decide things in Florida, are very anxious about a lot of Bush policies, particularly the economy, Medicare, Iraq, general direction of the country.
What do voters who support President Bush like about him, given that it is so close still?
Well, we have Florida, as everybody remembers, in 2000, is a very polarized state, and that's what we saw in our poll. It was Democrats very fired up against Bush and Republicans very fired up for Bush, and the battle is for the independent swing voter in Florida. And at this point in time, it looks like Kerry is winning that.
Tell us about the independent voters.
You know, a lot of these swing states, the numbers are very similar. In Florida, you've got basically about 40% of the electorate is Democrat, 40% is Republican, and there's 20% that is, you know, either one or the other party or independent that tend to go both ways. And that in Florida, it typically is in the central part of the state, basically from Daytona Beach to about St. Petersburg. And that is historically the battleground for the general election.
What do you make of the fact that in your poll, one in three of independent voters say they would support Bush? Two out of three say they'd support Kerry.
That is not good news for Bush at all at this point.
President,
and it probably explains why Bush-Cheney is spending a lot of their ad money in Florida right now.
President Bush is spending, in fact, $900,000 on television advertising in Florida and has visited 19 times. Tell me about one more factor, Ralph Nader.
Well, that remains to be seen. You know, in our poll, he was polling at 3%, which is basically the margin of error. You know, you talk to a lot of Democrats here and former Nader voters, and they say they will not do anything to help Nader that could keep Bush in the White House. There's a real question about whether Nader gets on the ballot. He has to get more than 90,000 signatures, and that's tough.
Adam, a lot of people think this election is going to boil down to whether people are voting for security, that's their main issue, or jobs and the economy, that's their main issue. What are you hearing as you follow John Kerry around Florida? What do people care about most at John Kerry rallies?
You know what, at a John Kerry rally, you tend to have your hardcore Democrats, but what they care about most is ABB, anybody but Bush, and beating George Bush.
Adam Smith is political editor for the St. Petersburg Times. He's following the Kerry campaign at the moment. Adam, thanks very much.
Sure.
President Bush's military budget is under fire on Capitol Hill, and not just from Democrats. The Senate takes up defense spending today, and lawmakers in the president's own party are feeling squeezed, concerned about paying for the war and trimming the record federal deficit. Joining us on the line is Jonathan Broder, defense and foreign policy editor at Congressional Quarterly. Jonathan, what are Republican defense spending naysayers saying?
You've got some senators who want to cut $7 billion from the budget, and that would come out of defense. And there are other Republicans who feel that the president should get what he wants on defense. The president wants approximately $423 billion for defense, and those who are worried about reducing the deficit want to reduce that by $7 billion. Mm-hmm. So You've got people who say the president needs that money and wants to take the cuts out of somewhere else.
Yeah, and we should remind people that the overall Senate budget still cuts taxes. So the question is, where's all the money going to come from?
Well, that's a good question.
And we should mention as well that the president's budget doesn't allocate any money for rebuilding Iraq and Afghanistan.
In fact, the president's budget doesn't allocate any money for anything in Iraq. What the administration prefers to do is to wait until after the election when it will submit what they call a supplemental spending request on top of the budget. And that is estimated to be as high as $50 billion. So a lot of people feel that this budget process is really a shell game, because whatever budget they come up with, if they do come up with a budget resolution, is going to be off by $50 billion.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you well know, the defense spending of this administration is being compared to the Reagan administration. But at that time, the money was being spent on equipment. Now it said there's a smaller fighting force and less equipment. So what does the president want to spend the money on?
Well, operations and maintenance. I mean, to keep an army of 110,000 men and women in Iraq and Afghanistan is a pretty expensive proposition. You've got fuel, you've got to upkeep your weapons.
And we understand salaries.
And salaries. Personnel costs are probably the biggest portion of the defense budget.
And the president says he's looking to raise salaries in order to make the military a better place for families in particular. So how tricky is this politically? We have a story coming up about accusations of a lack of armor to protect troops in Iraq. If Democrats make that an issue, can't Republicans fire back? Well, Democrats voted against spending on things like armor.
Well, that is one of the arguments that one can expect to hear. What you'll probably see during the budget debate is the Democrats will be wanting to underscore the fact that the president is emphasizing guns over butter, and what they will do is propose amendments that add money to education, for health, those kind of issues. What you have to remember, though, is that any kind of amendment for a budget resolution is going to require 60 votes in the full Senate, so it's very doubtful those amendments will pass.
Right. Well, as you've said, some in the Senate want to cut about $7 billion from the president's proposed budget. On the House side, some want to cut about $2 billion. They vote next week. Any predictions? Will the money go back in?
It's very, very hard to predict this. You've got a real battle going on here. There are 33, or I should say at least 33, House members, all Republicans, all defense hawks, who are resisting any cuts at all to the president's defense budget. Now, 33 members are enough to sink this budget proposal. And politically, that's quite significant, because usually, even though budget proposals are non-binding guidelines for the Congress on what to spend, they are usually party-line votes. Party discipline is enforced, or at least they try to. So if you've got 33 members, all Republicans, all defense hawks, voting against a Republican budget proposal, that's tantamount to a rebellion.
Jonathan, thank you.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Broder, Defense and Foreign Policy Editor at Congressional Quarterly.
In the last phone conversation Brian Hart had with his son, Private First Class John Hart, who was stationed in Iraq at the time, the 19-year-old soldier told his dad he felt unsafe driving around the country in an unarmored Humvee. Just days later, Private First Class John Hart was dead after his unarmored Humvee was struck by a round of sniper fire. Since his son's death, Brian Hart has been on a personal crusade to get armor into Humvees in Iraq. Brian Hart joins us on the line from Bedford, Massachusetts. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Bill.
Brian, start by telling us what happened to your son.
Well, John was killed in an ambush in Taza, Iraq, on October 18th. Their adjacent base was being attacked, and his three-vehicle convoy went to assist. They were ambushed on the way by RPGs and machine guns. They were basically shot up maybe 15 bullet holes through their vehicle. John was killed along with his lieutenant, David Bernstein, who bled to death.
What difference would an armored Humvee have made?
Well, it would almost certainly have saved David Bernstein, his lieutenant. The bullets literally went through the front of the vehicle, through the wheel well, the engine area, up his upper leg, and then out his thigh while he was in the passenger seat. And John, on the other hand, was a little less certain. The killing wound was to his neck.
How many others have died in Iraq in unarmored Humvees?
Based on the last few months' activity, it appears that about a third of the casualties are due to small arms, grenades, or improvised explosive devices hitting unarmored Humvees.
You began a crusade to change this situation. What proportion of Humvees contained armor at the time of the accident, and how has that changed?
Well, there were less than 400 armored Humvees in Iraq during the major offensive.
Out of how many Humvees in all?
About 9,000. There are about 8,400 unarmored Humvees in Iraq today, and that number is actually increasing. There are now 2,000 armored Humvees and about 8,500 unarmored ones in Iraq today. The Army, just recently at the Armed Services Committee hearing, said that the Army-wide need for armored Humvees is about 11,000, and they need about 4,100 immediately in Iraq.
So it sounds like at the moment there about a fifth of the Humvees are armored. How quickly will it get up to a situation where, as you say, 11,000 Humvees are armored?
That isn't even in the cards. The Army's current production schedule would meet an only a 3,300-unit requirement by the summer of 2005. So the situation is so underfunded that it has no chance of catching up short of a major change in priorities.
Brian, is this problem addressed in the new budget that President George Bush has put out?
Actually, it isn't. We expected it to be, but when the February 2nd budget came out for fiscal year 05, there was zero money allocated for retrofit armor for the existing 8,300-odd Humvees in-country, and for armored Humvees, while the plants could produce about 500 per month, the Army only purchased 818 for the entire year, so about 2 months' worth of production. So the Army simply hasn't funded the allocation, and it appears that they're holding back the money because Rumsfeld doesn't want to go back to Congress before the election to ask for supplemental appropriation.
There was concern that the Humvees could become too heavy, right? You're adding about a ton and a half of weight when you armor a Humvee, and that slows them down.
It does, but the way we're structured now, these unarmored vehicles allow anybody with a hand grenade to pick off American casualties. There's no reason to provide such a weakness to our enemies.
Just to finish up, Brian, what are you specifically doing now to change this situation?
What I want to see happen is production plants move to full capacity, which would be about 500 vehicles a month, until the problem is resolved. Several hundred killed or wounded young men and women can be avoided if we'll simply address the problem now versus waiting a couple of years to resolve it.
Brian Hart joined us from Bedford, Massachusetts. His son, Private First Class John Hart, died in Iraq last October. Brian, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, one man's attempts to bring Sunni and Shiite together in Iraq.
And later in the show, daring to protest Tiananmen Square in China.
There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The 25 members of Iraq's governing council formally signed that country's interim constitution this morning. The 25-page document sets up a future Iraqi parliament and presidency. It enshrines Islam as the basis of law, but also includes a Bill of Rights that guarantees freedom of thought, expression, and assembly, and the right to organize freely without regard to sex, religion, or ethnic origin. This morning's signing came after a three-day delay caused by top Shia cleric Ayatollah al-Sistani, who objected to a provision that gives extra veto power to Iraqi Kurds. In the end, al-Sistani didn't prevent the Shiite members of the council from endorsing the interim constitution, though after the signing today, he criticized its legitimacy.
Well, today's signing ceremony brings Iraq one step closer to the planned handover of power from U.S.-led forces to an Iraqi government. But the delay in signing underscores the power of Iraq's clerics in a society fundamentally divided along religious and tribal lines. Those divisions and a string of recent attacks, including the bombings last week that killed nearly 200 Shiite worshippers, make some observers fear civil war is inevitable. Yet there are positive signs. One of them, the Baghdad Religious Accord, a pledge by senior clerics and politicians of all stripes to work together so that Iraqis may live together as one family. The Reverend Canon Andrew White had a hand in creating that accord. Canon White is the Anglican Church envoy to the Middle East and the director of the newly formed Iraqi Institute for Religious Tolerance. We caught up with him Friday and asked, can the clerics make good on their declaration, or is Iraq headed for civil war?
Well, I think it's a very real risk that civil war could occur, and that's one of the reasons why we as religious leaders, particularly the Shia and Sunni leaders, but with Kurdish and Turkmen and Sabis and Yazidi and other minority religious groups, worked so hard to actually put together the Baghdad Religious Accord last week and to form the Iraqi Center for Dialogue, Reconciliation and Peace.
Canon White, can you do us a favor and take us inside one of the rooms that you've been in with some of the Shia and Sunni clerics and give us an example of an exchange that illustrates either the difficulty of what lies ahead or the hope that you have?
Well, it was actually only 10 days ago that we brought together the Sunni and the Shia clerics for the first time. If you can imagine the Ayatollahs in their turbans and the Sunni leaders in their kafirs sitting in a room waiting for the members of the governing council to arrive, too afraid to even talk to each other. By the end of the day, they had not only had an exchange with each other, but they had actually started the process of becoming friends. Just a week ago on Thursday, we gathered in Al-Kadmir, Ambassador Paul Bremer with the British envoy, Sir Jeremy Greenstock, with Ambassador Ricardo Aldoni from the State Department, along with the Ayatollahs and the Sunni leaders. And we actually had a fun evening together. And this is something of an almost miracle. If you can imagine, here Americans, British diplomats, with Ayatollahs and Sunni leaders and Christian bishops sitting together, eating dinner, becoming friends. That was the first sign of real hope.
An example, perhaps, of what a Shia cleric might say to a Sunni cleric having met one for the first time.
Well, obviously everything happens in Arabic. A lot of it is surrounding discussions of classical Arabic texts and Quranic greetings. And then they began to talk about their real fears, the fears that the Shia community have of a backlash from the Sunni and the fears of the Sunni community from the Shia majority. And then they started talking about this almost miraculous document, which they all agreed to, saying that Iraq is a land which is holy to all three traditions, and that bloodshed in this land is a desecration of religion, not just in Iraq, but in the world as a whole. And they pledged themselves to work together to prevent the demonization of the other and to work to try and ensure that the next generation are educated to respect and live together, not just as neighbors, but as one family.
Well, here you are, a Christian, an Englishman. Especially as a Christian, aren't you seen by some of these other faiths as sort of meddling in their business?
Well, I've been involved in Iraq for a very long while. I didn't turn up just following the war. I was there for 6 years before the war and formed a very close relationship with a number of the Ayatollahs and the Sunni religious leaders as well. And they actually asked me if I would help them negotiate a deal. I think everything, particularly in the Middle East, is based on relationship. And if you have the trust of individuals and the trust of the coalition who we're working with, then we have a real chance for hope and the ability to move forward.
Is there a way you can share with us some of the things they talked about?
Well, what one of the Ayatollahs said was, he turned to Paul Bremer and said, "Thank you for enabling the cloud of darkness to remove from our land. Thank you for allowing the sun to shine again on our nation." So despite all of the difficulties, there is still optimism that a new dawn is facing the nation and people of Iraq. And I must say, as one who has spent many years working in and out of Iraq, Iraq today, despite its security problems, is a far better place than Iraq a year ago.
Canon White, thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
The Reverend Canon Andrew White, the Anglican Church's envoy to the Middle East and the director of the newly formed Iraqi Institute for Religious Tolerance.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A Chinese army doctor who became a national hero last year for exposing the government cover-up of the SARS outbreak has again challenged the Beijing government to come clean, this time on one of the darkest periods in modern Chinese history. Dr. Jiang Yanyang recently sent a letter to the National People's Congress saying it's time to admit that the brutal crackdown on pro-democracy protests in June of 1989 in Tiananmen Square was a mistake. Joining us from Beijing is Matt Pottinger. He's a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you.
Matt, let's first talk about Dr. Jiang Yanyang. Tell me about him.
Well, Dr. Jiang became a very prominent figure about a year ago. That's when there was a SARS epidemic raging in several parts of China, and there was a government cover-up going on because the government was really scared about that it would hurt the economy. He was the first doctor to stand up publicly and challenge the government. He wrote a letter that was published by foreign media detailing scores of cases of SARS in the capital. And finally, the World Health Organization took Beijing to task on this, and Beijing reversed course, stopped covering up these cases, and actually did something to halt the spread of the disease.
He became a national hero. Now, back in 1989, he was at Tiananmen Square working as a doctor. What's the letter say?
It starts really with his own recollections, quite graphic recollections of what he saw that night. And he was clearly shattered by the experience of seeing young people brought in, and many of them dying on his operation table. And he's been haunted by it, and that's the main thing that he's writing about. His argument to the party is that the party can save itself and actually enhance its prestige if it comes clean on the notion that this was a terrible mistake by the party, rather than letting it fester and making people more angry. In his words, he says people are becoming more angry. In truth, I'm not sure if that's the assessment that a lot of Chinese people, including veterans of that demonstration, would agree with. Right now, China's economy has been soaring, 9% growth last year, and people are more preoccupied with making money than they are really haunted by the ghosts of Tiananmen Square.
Are average Chinese aware of this letter?
That's a great question. Certainly, the media itself, newspapers, TV, won't come near it. They're not going to touch it because they're controlled by the state. But yes, people are going to find out about it on chat rooms and in internet discussions and through dribs and drabs of foreign media reports that do make it through or over the firewall that protects the Chinese internet.
So finally, Dr. Yan Yang has been questioned. What happens now?
That's right. He was questioned today by a couple of officials who wanted to know how the letter had made its way into the hands of foreign media. He says he doesn't know himself. And we're just going to have to wait and see over the next several days whether the Chinese government leaves it at that or if they decide to take some kind of action against him.
What do you think the chances are that this man in his 70s, this national hero, would go to jail?
I think that the chances he would go to jail are remote, but that certainly he is under surveillance at this point and is going to be feeling heat for some time to come.
Matt Pottinger joined us from Beijing. He's a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and its sister paper, The Far Eastern Economic Review. Matt, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Warren Buffett, the second wealthiest person in the world behind Bill Gates, head of Berkshire Hathaway, and the man many people call the Sage of Omaha, recently sent out his annual letter to shareholders. Every year, that letter causes ripples throughout the business world because of its hard-boiled humor and commentaries on corporate America and its forecast for the future. So, what did Warren have to say? Financial Times reporter Dan Roberts wrote about the letter today. Dan, as I read in your article, Warren Buffett has the envious problem of too much cash.
Yes, he's sitting on a mountain of this stuff. But the interesting thing is that it shows he's very skeptical about the valuations out there in the stock market and elsewhere. You know, he doesn't want to spend this money. He's keeping it under the bed at the moment.
He is. He's literally saying the saddest thing is I have all this capital and no place to use it. And some would say, why not invest in stocks? What does he say?
Well, he's worried that valuations never really recovered from the bubble. There was a brief window when stocks became cheaper a couple of years ago, but they've caught up dramatically in the last 12 months. And he just feels that lots of companies are overvalued. He has a healthy dose of skepticism. And at the same time, to be fair to him, he's got money rolling in. His insurance business is doing very well. And there's just billions of dollars pouring into that business at the moment.
You're speaking to us from the newsroom of the Financial Times. I imagine every reporter is poring over this letter. Give us a laundry list of some of the other things that strike you as interesting.
Well, he once again, he weighs into corporate governance and some of the behavior of his peers. He suggests that the attempts to reform corporate governance in America will never really work until CEOs start addressing their own pay. And on this, he's pretty pessimistic. He singles out Jeff Immelt at General Electric as one CEO who's done a bit to address this. But for the rest of America, he feels that people are still paying themselves too much.
Right. And companies are getting too many breaks. He says, if class warfare is being waged in America, my class is clearly winning.
Yes, he's very sensitive on the issue of tax. He suffered a veiled criticism about the amount of tax that Berkshire Hathaway pays, and he pointed out that Berkshire pays an enormous amount of tax, so much so that his tax return is 7 feet high. But at the same time, he says lots of other companies are finding ways to dodge tax, reduce their tax rates far below the 35% they ought to pay, and he feels this is unfair.
This week, the U.S. government will report trade figures. Now, the U.S. has a huge trade deficit. It is in debt to other countries. What did he say about that and its impact on the dollar?
Yes, this is another area where he's very cautious at the moment about the falling dollar, both about what's causing the falling dollar, which is America's trade deficit with the rest of the world, but also its likely impacts. He says he doesn't really know what the falling dollar will do eventually, but he fears that it may have ramifications far beyond finance, which is kind of worrying. And he's also balanced or hedged his exposure to the dollar by buying a lot of foreign currencies, which for someone who's got so much invested in America and has traditionally been very, one would say, almost patriotic about his investment in America, is again quite a worrying sign.
And remind us, why are people like Warren Buffett concerned about a trade imbalance?
Well, ultimately, it means that more and more America is owned by foreigners. In order to sustain the trade imbalance, countries like China, central banks have to buy U.S. government debt to balance the trade flows.
They buy treasury bonds.
They buy treasury bonds. And that's what's been happening up until now. And Mr. Buffett sort of quite rightly says this is a call on the future wealth of America. You know, this is another form of outsourcing in a way.
Yeah. If they all decide to cash those bonds at the same time, we're in big trouble.
Absolutely.
Well, Dan Roberts, thank you.
Okay, good speaking to you.
Dan Roberts, a reporter at the Financial Times.
Still to come, our jazz critic, James Isaacs, who says even if you haven't seen the animated film, The Triplets of Belleville, you ought to hear the soundtrack.
You're listening to Here and Now. The opening sounds of Portal of Prayer, an audio art piece created by Ellen Band using her own recordings from a wide variety of religious and spiritual sources, including the Navajo Nation, the Hindu, Muslim, Jewish, and Christian faiths. The composition is being played continuously at Boston's Logan Airport and at the Boston Public Library. Ellen Band says she hopes her work gets people to look at prayer in a new light.
The statement, in a nutshell, that I'm trying to make is that prayer can happen anywhere. It doesn't have to occur in a traditional, formal setting. What I'm really focusing on here is how prayer takes musical traditions to incredible heights. I did mix a lot of different traditions together on purpose, and I never intended this piece to be a walk-through tour of religions. That's not what I do. I take sound from everyday life and I recontextualize it into a form that is not the form in which you would ever hear it in a real life setting. There are plenty of juxtapositions of Muslim, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. I did that on purpose. Part of me did that because, you know, I don't want to sound sort of simplistic or naive, but why shouldn't we all be together? Why should we be separate? We're sharing not just the world, but we all share the common need to pray. So why shouldn't we pray together? There were certain sound samples that I liked so much that I knew that I wanted to turn them into something I call clouds. And so here's one example from an ascension service at Trinity Church in Boston. And here it is. Then just that small sample was put into a long delay with reverb and turned into this. The clouds really are there as a structure out of which the other voices appear and then disappear back into the cloud. I've been doing sound art for 30 years. I've been part of the Jewish religion my whole life, but this is the first time I've been able to bridge them into one expression. So there's no proselytizing in here. It is really meant to convey the experience of people at prayer and the emotional and sonic components that are part of that. And that's why it's a piece of music.
Ellen Band's sound installation, Portal of Prayer, can be heard at Boston's Logan Airport and the Public Library. Our story was produced by WBUR's Walter Dixon. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
With an ear for great music that may be just under the radar for many of us, Here and Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs joins us in the studio with two new highly recommended CDs. And James, it's always great to hear what you have to say and have us listen to. Welcome.
How are you doing, Robin?
Good. People pitch a lot of CDs to you. These two jumped out. Why?
Well, I guess these two jumped out at me because one is the product of a truly extraordinarily beautiful voice. And the other, I've always enjoyed eccentric styled music. And in this case, eccentric music keyed to a film, an animated film, that has won considerable accolades of late. In fact, it was nominated twice for Academy Awards recently.
Well, let's start with that. It's the movie The Triplets of Belleville. When I saw snippets of this on the Oscar show, I thought, I want to see this movie. The movie and a song from the film nominated for two Oscars. Who composed the music?
The music was written by a multi-instrumentalist whose principal instrument, I think, is guitar. His name is Ben Charest, C-H-A-R-E-S-T. And the musical influences that inform the soundtrack of this film, as far as I can discern, are the Boswell Sisters, which was a New Orleans-based harmony trio group of the 1930s. Of course, Django Reinhardt and his chugging gypsy jazz. Then you get Georges Delerue, who was a prominent French film composer, not just for French films, by the way, but he wrote extensively for Truffaut movies in the 1960s, 50s and 60s.
Well, let's listen to a little. The song that was nominated for an Oscar is called?
It's called Belleville Rendezvous. I should point out that this is not strictly a French movie. It's French, Belgian, and Canadian. And here are Les Triplets de Belleville. Je pas finir ma vie à Capouco. On s'est tout raide avec des gigolos. Moi je veux être tordu, triplement tordu, balancé comme une triplette de Belleville.
Film about. The clip I saw, there were three elderly women doing this sort of like song and dance.
Those are the triplets.
So it looked hilarious.
Okay, well, it is a film in which a grandmother who lives with her mopey, chubby grandson in a working class arrondissement, I'm guessing, of Paris, she doesn't quite know what to do with the boy. He's very lonely. He's got these limpid pools for eyes and this long French Gallic nose, you know, and he just kind of hangs around the house. Well, first she buys him a dog who turns into the world's fattest bloodhound. He's a wonderful dog named Bruno. And then she notices under the boy's bed a book about the Tour de France. So he likes bicycles. So first she gets him a tricycle, and then he becomes, his name is Champion, this boy, and he becomes a bicycle rider. And he competes in the Tour de France. Unfortunately, he's kidnapped by the evil French mafia.
Okay, this could all happen.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
How does the music drive it forward?
The triplets at the beginning, you know, it sets the scene of what France was like in the 1930s. You know, Django's on stage for a brief moment. Fred Astaire is there, Josephine Baker, just the whole cabaret thing. And there's almost no dialogue. So the music is the thing, the music and the animation, which is quite extraordinary. Now, to me, that's the Georges Delerue / crime jazz influenced piece called Bruno's Theme. When they're looking for the kidnapped Champion, I think that's when it comes up.
Can you listen to this CD if you've never seen the movie?
You can, but I think it would help somewhat to have seen the movie. And did we mention the filmmaker's name?
No, we didn't.
His name is Sylvain Chaumet, and he is really quite an animator.
Let's listen to another song, Cabaret Hoover.
Yeah, it sounds odd because one of the instruments is, in fact, a vacuum cleaner. It's in 3/4 time. We have one of the triplets playing the inside shelving of a refrigerator. It all starts, though, with one of the triplets setting the rhythm on a newspaper, kind of like this here. And the third triplet arrives with her Hoover vacuum cleaner. And then Grandma, the grandmother of the kidnapped bicycle rider, plays the spokes of a bicycle wheel. This is very African-sounding music, though, and it's one of my favorite scenes in the film.
Cabaret Hoover, from the soundtrack to The Triplets of Belleville. It sounds wonderful, James.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good music elsewhere in this CD. Okay. The Triplets of Belleville, composed by Ben Charest, filmed by Sylvain Chomet.
Wonderful. Now, another CD you recommend, vocalist Tierney Sutton, a name I feel I don't know.
Well, she's been around for, I would say, 6 years in jazz's big leagues. I think she's made about 5 or 6 albums in that time. And her latest album is called Dancing in the Dark, inspired by the music of Frank Sinatra. Well, of course, Frank Sinatra didn't really write music, but he did inspire musicians over the years, many musicians. She tried to go a little bit off the beaten path in selecting her repertoire of Sinatra-associated songs. And she is backed by the working trio that's been with her for quite a while now. Christian Jacob is the pianist, Trey Henry the bassist, Ray Brinker the drummer. And there's strings at times. There is a string section at times on the album, conducted by Christian Jekyll.
What'll I do with just a photograph to tell?
There is some improvisation, as in the next tune that we'll hear. The first one, by the way, was What'll I Do, written by Irving Berlin, I think in the 1920s. Usually it's a waltz. They did not take it as a waltz. There are any number of changes of the basic arrangements or the structures of the songs in this album.
Let's listen to another one, Where or When, written by Rodgers and Hart.
True, and this is, I think, the jazziest example of Tierney Sutton's art in this disc.
The smile you're smiling, you were smiling then, but I can't remember where or when. Some things that happened for the first time, they seem to be happening again. And so it seems that we have met before. We've laughed before, we've loved before. But who knows where or when?
I love her voice. Tell me a little bit about Tierney Sutton. Who is she?
Well, she's 40 years old, originally from Milwaukee. She now lives in Los Angeles. Recently, her voice has turned up in commercials, BMW, Coca-Cola, Dodge, and JCPenney. And I haven't seen this film yet, but I'm told that she is part of the soundtrack, that her voice is part of the soundtrack for the William H. Macy, Alec Baldwin movie, The Cooler. Her voice is getting out there now, and it deserves to be out there even more so.
Well, James Isaacs, thank you for putting her on our radar screen if she wasn't already. Thank you.
My pleasure, Rob.
And we'll go out with Tierney Sutton's Fly Me to the Moon.
Written by a man who, sadly, just left this world at age 88, Bart Howard. You'd have to call this tune his greatest hit. Again, a creative arrangement. They take the theme in 7/4 samba time, Tierney Sutton and her rhythm section, Fly Me to the Moon.
Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you. Thank you.
Here Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs. For more information on his latest picks, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.